Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
I was quoted on in the Albuquerque Journal on the front page, and everybody said, "Oh, you're like a climate denier." I said, "No, man, that's like, you know, they got like more lobsters than they ever had. Their range has expanded, and you know, the trout in certain places are doing better." Now, that would be nice if that lasts, but it's probably going to all end in a big explosion one day.
That was Taylor Streit sharing a perspective on the changing climate conditions, one of the most unique states in our union, today on the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how you doing today? Thank you for stopping in on the show. Before we get rolling here, I wanted to remind you to check out a podcast. If you haven't heard of the Destination Angler podcast, Steve does a great job hosting the Destination Angler, and actually had Taylor's son, Nick, on, and they went deep on the Rio Grande. So after this one, you can click over there and take a listen to the Destination Angler and keep this party going strong. Lake Lady Rods builds distinctive custom rods, each created one at a time to the exact specifications for you. Lake Lady only uses world-class top-of-the-line products and components. Just ask some of the governors and senators that Chris has produced rods for in the past. These rods are crafted to be the most sensitive tool a discriminating angler can ask for. Please head over to wetflyswing.com/lakelady to check it out right now. That's wetflyswing.com/lakelady. Established in 1928, Deddy Flies is the oldest family-run fly shop in the country, now in their 94th season. Deddy's mission has always been to supply the fly fishing community with the finest products and services. Each fly they sell is either tied in-house or by a handful of select domestic tires. And we've talked to a few of them on the show, so it's been great to connect with Deddy here. Please head over to wetflyswing.com/deddy. to connect with them right now. That's wetflyswing.com/deddy, DETTE. You support this podcast and the oldest family-run fly shop in the country. Taylor Streit, who has been leading his own style of fly shop and fly fishing adventures, shares his very cool story today. We hear his story of building a fishing business during the Woodstock days, find out about his battle with alcohol and how that affected his life during a period of time, and also all this, how it revolves around the Taos, the very popular Taos fly shop. Once again, we covered it all today, including a full breakdown on fly fishing New Mexico. So without further ado, here is Taylor Streit from TaosFlyShop.com.
How's it going, Taylor?
It's going. Yeah, it's going fine.
So Taylor, this has been a little long time coming. I'm not sure who first referenced you, but it was a while back. I want to say it was somebody over on the East Coast, and I've been wanting to make a connection with you for a while because you're down in New Mexico in a really what seems like an amazing part of the country. So we're gonna talk about that and the fly shop you created. But take us back. I always love to go back to the start really quickly. Talk about how you first got into fly fishing.
Well, you know, it's funny because just in preparation for talking to you, I listened to Nick Lyons just now, the interview you did. And it was, and my instinctive fly fishing book is with Lyons Press. And Nick helped me with the title. And then he, before like the year he retired, something like that, like I think it was 2000, 2002, somewhere in there, he approved it. I mean, he's the one who took it. But we go way back to when I was a teenager working for Francis Pedersen Neil Sable. But we used to email, and we talked about, because he just talked about that on the thing you did, about fishing as a kid, and how I said, Nick, I've moved away from a fishing country or trout fishing country, and I'm fishing for catfish, and you know, and I'm watching that red and white bobber. Oh my God, it's just enchanting. And he says, oh, I love that too. That's just like the man, that's where it all starts. And with me, the first fishing memory I have, I'm actually trying to write my memoirs, and the first fishing memory I have is a red and white plastic bobber. They had plastic in 1950. And and it jiggled just the tiniest little bit. And I slung back, and it came and hit me right on the forehead, cracked and broke. And so not my head, but the but the bobber, right? So that was the first, you know, that was my start. But I was insane, you know. I was just like, who knows how that all happened? But it, just for anything outdoors, really. And yeah, I was caught.
So good. So we're back into it, and you got the red and white bobber, which everybody knows. Everybody loves the old red white bobber. How did you, you know, where did fly fishing come into you?
Well, the fly fishing part started, I think, the neighbors where I lived, which was in the Hudson Valley in New York. They fished and serious fly fishermen, and they took me fishing. And my dad did too, but my dad was, you know, trying to make a go of his work, you know. So they took me fishing, and I just was writing about it. And one of the guys, Herb Dickerson, and he was friends with Eric Leiser, and he, you know, they were the real in crowd in the Catskill fishing. And I'd go fishing with him, and he was a purist, and so he'd only fish dry flies. And I'm like, you know, 10 years old and supposed to be sitting on the bank looking for fish to rise. I mean, that's that, you know, that don't work. So I would take off and go fish, and I'd come back towards dark, and Herb hadn't made a cast, you know. So that was the I learned quick about the different manners of fly fishing and how people go off in their notions.
That's it. And that's really cool, because the Catskills, we hear a lot about that. We have a lot of listeners in the Northeast as well. And you were brought up kind of, it sounds like, with one of the traditional, the great, you know, amazing types of fishing. So you have, do you feel like that really influenced where you went as you got in, moved your way out west?
Well, what happened was, I'd be fishing the Esopus and the Beaverkill in the Catskills, fishing in the Catskills and the Beaverkill and the Esopus and the Schoharie. And we fished out of Phoenicia. I haven't been there in 60 years. But it was a great education, especially fishing the Beaverkill. I remember being on the Beaverkill one evening when there was there's a fish rising every foot. And, you know, it was just, it was one of those occasions which happens on every trout stream about a couple times a year when every fish is feeding in the whole river. But then when I was just after high school, I got tuberculosis, and I was in the hospital for a few months, and I got out of there, and that and changed my life. And then I'm just going to fish for the rest of my life. And and drink and smoke a lot of dope. So I ended up working for Francis Betters on the Au Sable near Lake Placid, Wilmington, New York. And he was a very famous cat, and he developed some flies and the Au Sable wolf. And I tied flies for him for 15 cents each, and I guided. And I guided Nick Lyons once. And then Nick wrote in a letter to the editor in the New York Times in 1967 before he started in the book business. So I've teased him about this and tried to get him to put this on the back of my instinctive book, but he thought it was too extreme, because in that article he called me a monstrous predator because I had all, you know, it was before Catch and Release. And so we made, you know, aluminum foil cylinders out of all the fish in the freezer, you know, and they just were all wasted virtually, you know, and then you try and eat them a year later. But so I did that for a couple of years, and that's where I really started in the fishing business, you know.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah, yeah. And then I moved to New Mexico after.
And how old were you when you moved to New Mexico?
I was about 20.
20. Yeah, yeah. So, and this was, what year was this?
Well, that would have been in 69. I went, I was at Woodstock, and there were some people from New Mexico that I met there, hog farmers, commune people. And I don't know how in the world they could have talked me into going there, but I went, and there's some interesting stories disregarding fishing, carrying on for quite a few years there. Yeah.
Quite a few years. So this is good. I love this. So Woodstock, we're back to Woodstock. Uh-huh. And really that influenced you to get out to New Mexico. So what was, so once you got to New Mexico, I mean, what were you doing there from then until, you know, were you just fishing all the time?
Well, there was a whole lot of it. Yeah, there was a whole lot of fishing. I got a job tying flies for the sporting goods store there in Taos. And, you know, that was not part of the United States then. And, I mean, it was no longer the territory of New Mexico, but, I mean, things rolled much differently there than they do in the rest of America. And I lived on a commune for quite some time, and then built my own adobe house, and I'd be in the fishing, tying flies usually, and that went on for some time, and I would write some, and I wasn't very good at it. I read something the other day, but then I started Tal's Fly Shop in 1980, the same year, the same year my son Nick was born. And now Nick has the Taos Fly Shop, and it's now a very, very large business. And I skipped over a lot of stuff there, but all the time fishing, and you know, like now people can, with the incredible quality of guiding in the Rocky Mountains of the United States. In other parts of the United States, the people learn to fly fish real fast if they hire a guide, you know. So,
yeah,
I didn't have that. I think I heard you describe it, the self-taught cast. You know, it's not pretty, and I did things like I went to Mel Krieger's casting school. A client, a client took me as a tip. And that was a week long school, and Mel taught me to recast, and then I had other almost adventures with Mel, and well, it just carries on. I mean, that's
You've had a full thing. This is interesting because we're going to dig into a little bit of you know, some of the fishing here in a sec. I want to take it back because I think it was maybe Ed Engel mentioned like Woodstock, and obviously I was never at Woodstock, so I missed it. But I would have loved to have gone. But give me a Woodstock story before we get into the fishing. I'm sure you've got a lot of stuff, but what was that? How did that influence your life?
Well, I live just I don't know 30, 40 miles away from there, and I had this girlfriend and her sister, and we took off to go over there, and we were late, you know, like a day late, and we're driving in the freeway, which was miles and miles and miles from the thing, and it's dark, and this guy goes tripping across the freeway, you know, like lunging forward, right? And I go, hey, that's Johnny. That's Johnny DeNorfio. And so and he looked at us, and his eyes were rolling around, and he said, "Don't take the purple acid." And then he just took off into the bush, you know.
Oh, wow.
So, Anyway,
nice.
So
that was Woodstock. Woodstock was a lot of people that were tripping around.
And we drove to within about 2 miles. We passed like 20 miles of parked cars, and we drove right up to the place and parked right there. And then Creedence Clearwater was playing as we walked, the perfect walking music.
Holy cow.
And then the hog farm was feeding free food. And then I ended up, being on a commune.
That's right. The commune.
Yeah. Right.
Well, maybe we'll hold the commune question till the end if we have time. But I want to dig into a little bit on, the Rio Grande. And I mean, there's some pretty amazing rivers that a lot of people hear about. And I know you've guided and you've taught out there for years. But talk about that. Let's start us first. Somebody who maybe hasn't been to New Mexico, and obviously you're down below Colorado. I'm kind of curious. What is you're kind of up north, right? Taos is a little north. How similar is it? More similar to say a Colorado, or more similar to say an Albuquerque?
Oh, it's its own thing. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Taos is under the tallest mountain in the state, which is Mount Wheeler, which is 13 something. And so there's a lot of above timberline country. I mean, it's the high Rockies. And just 50 miles north in Colorado is Mount Blanco, which is 14,400 and something. So, yeah, no, it's the proper Rockies. And so the rest of that territory, there's another branch of the Rockies that come down. That's the Sangre de Cristos, right at Taos, but the San Juan Mountains kind of melt into the Tusas Mountains once they get into New Mexico, and there's a lot of streams in there, and the Chama River and stuff. But the Rio Grande is the main drainage, and it's got that it's in a big nasty canyon, and so it's not fished all that much, and it's a lot of big 19-20 inch is normally about the biggest fish, the biggest that trout get under normal circumstances, unless they're in the tailwater or unless they're fed. And these are all, of course, wild fish, so they wouldn't know what feed looks like. So, it's very, very rugged. And, I have a new book. I think I sent it to you, which is Fly Fish Taos Santa Fe. And I had another guidebook that, Fly Fishing New Mexico. And then there's a couple other with very similar titles. So I had to call it Fly Fish Taos Santa Fe, which, obviously you're not fishing in the cities. So it covers all of northern New Mexico, including the San Juan. And it's up to date. I've published it myself. And so I carry it around and sell it. And unfortunately, the book business is not in the best of shape. So I went to one town, and they had three bookstores, and there wasn't a new book in the whole thing. They're all used books.
Yeah. I think this is I have the book here. I'm looking at it. Yeah, it's really nice. It's definitely colorful. You have some great maps in it and stuff like that, and you got the all the big rivers. And the Rio Grande is one of those rivers. Let's go there for a second. Talk about the Rio Grande. Like, if somebody's coming in there, they're flying in, they're driving in, and they want to get some fishing in, what are they looking at? What's that river? What should they be thinking? Do they need a boat? Can they hike in? What are they doing there?
Well, you can our guiding business, Taos Fly Shop's guiding business, and Real Life at Santa Fe, which my son also owns, with Ivan Valdez. But we do float the bottom few miles of the river, but most of the river is Class 5 rapids. So, it's you can't take your life in your hands to catch a fish, but you can hike into a lot of the river. But that's certainly not for everyone, and we screen clients real carefully about who to take where. But there are miles of the river that is got a highway next to it, and of course it doesn't fish like the remote parts of the canyon, but it can be quite good, especially in the off season because it's the lower part of the river, so the water's warmer and it has very good, like BWO hatches in late winter, and also in late fall too. And then also another thing about the Rio is it's a year round river. It's what I have called the upside of global warming. I mean, it fishes, 300 days a year. And yep. There's a caddis hatch, a pre-runoff caddis hatch that occurs in April. Used to be in mid-April. It's probably more now like early April. And it can be a quite astounding hatch. And you get to skate dry flies. Yeah. And then the fish are really dumb at that time of year, in the spring. And so that's a really exciting thing to do is that early caddis hatch for sure.
Early caddis. And and then what if you look out as you go into, say, late April into May, what's that looking like as far as fishing hatches and things like that?
Well, May is going to be run off in the Rio. So May is going to suck pretty much. So
no good.
Yeah. And then, it just, there's a lot of irrigation things that go on with that. I live now on the lower part of the Rio Grande, almost by Mexico, and where I catch all the catfish and walleye and such. And so this is where the water gets used, is the pecan farms down here. And so it's just, the irrigation's king in New Mexico, and so we don't know. But the low flows, and I have this in my instinctive book, narrow canyon streams almost always fish best the lower they are, and because then you can get at the fish. And that's the case in the Rio. So it's fished very, very well in the last few years. I mean, just incredible fishing, and that's all wild fish, and a part of that's to do with the otters. They've been reintroduced, and they have been a detriment in a couple of cases where there's a lot of spawning. Mm-hmm. But in the Rio itself, they've cleaned up the carp, and which is a major competition. And they've cleaned up the crayfish, which is another major non-native competition to the trout. And so trout numbers have gone up considerably. And it's made up of probably 75% browns, 25% cutbows. They have a distinct kind of cutthroat slash. And then there'll be stalkers, along the highway, of course. But there's smallmouth and pike, but the pike have been hit hard by the otters, it appears. We don't know where they've gone, but they're not as numerous as they used to be. I was listening to your show with Larry Dahlberg. And we have places in the canyon where you can get up, not like the full 600-foot part of the canyon, but a much lower, which is perfect for sight fishing where you can see down. So when you guide it for pike, you have your client down below and you're up on the ledge and you can spot the fish from up above. And then depending on how deep they are, you give them that brilliant Dahlberg diver and you just put it on its nose and strip it until they can't resist. And anyway, sight fishing for 40-inch pike is quite a thrill.
Wow. This is in the Rio Grande.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Wow. So that sounds pretty interesting. You have not only the trout species, but you add pike, which you don't find everywhere. How long have pike have been there for a while?
I don't know. Nobody seems to know how long they've been there. They were probably put into a reservoir down below and then moved up. They're mostly in Colorado in the San Luis Valley. Which is just an hour above Taos. And then there's a lake east of Taos, about 40 minutes away, called Eagle Nest Lake, which is a very rich fishery. And it has somebody, who knows who, dumped some pike in there some, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. And they have reached about, I think, their maximum length, which seems to be, for that place, about 45 inches. And I was with my son one day when, in fact, there's a picture in the new book of Nick mm-hmm. with two 45-inch pike, which you have to keep. They made a law that you have to keep the pike. But, yeah, so that's another interesting. And that Eagle Nest Lake is in a very good trout fishery at times, too.
Oh, it is. Yeah. So you got, so basically painting the scene, you guys are, yeah, you're in the Rockies, you're in, you know, New Mexico, but essentially you're at a high elevation. And what is the elevation of Taos, the town itself?
7,000 feet.
Oh yeah. So you're way up there. Yeah. So you're way high.
Yeah. Santa Fe's yeah. even 7,000 feet. Yeah.
Yeah, even Santa Fe, everything's big. So this is cool. So, so what is so for those that don't know Taos or the area, what do you really love about New Mexico and living out there?
Well, New Mexico is not the proper America, you know.
Why is that? You mentioned that before. Why is it? Why does it seem like it's different than say everything else? Say Colorado.
Well, people are all different colors, and they're all different. makeups, and there's some good and there's some bad. There's a lot of violence, to be frank, in Albuquerque, certainly. And, you know, they didn't just make up Breaking Bad, you know.
Huh.
And, but there's a lot of artists. There's the landscapes are just incredibly unique in every direction you look. And to my liking is it's extremely light population, especially especially in southern New Mexico. I live right next to the Gila, and my neighbor, a buddy of mine, I consider him my neighbor, and he's 100 miles away. And so
that's amazing.
I haven't had anybody drive up to my house in a while. It gets a little lonely, so.
You're right. So you'd think that, you know, because you look at California, Colorado, some of these places, you would think that, yeah, maybe more people would be piling into New Mexico because it's such a light, you know,
warm. Yeah, and that's true. That's true.
Yeah, it is true.
It's happening. And Taos is a whole different story. There's a lot of people there now. I mean, that's just, a, you know, 20 years ago, it was just maybe 20,000 people. But seems like there's a million now. But it's still, you know, there's a lot of art. There's a lot of different kind of thinking. And there's most people, you know, you get faced with all of the realities of New Mexico, the poverty and pregnancy and violence and this and that. But nobody really wants to leave.
Right. It's because kinda, of the weather.
The weather's good, but it's just New Mexico. It's one of a kind.
This is awesome. I have a friend that actually lives in near Taos, and I haven't been there yet, and you know, but I'm hoping to make a road trip. So if we were to make a road trip out there, let's say in April before the high water hits, coming in there, what would you recommend for me to do? Should I just drive into the fly shop and check in with Nick, or what would you recommend?
Well, from where you're coming from, you'd probably go by the San Juan. And we have a permit to guide on the San Juan, and that's mostly float fishing. And I got one guide, Ron Sadal, who is exceptionally schooled on the San Juan. And the fishing there is not what it was 20, 30 years ago, but it's changed. And he's targeting these unbelievably big, like Tierra del Fuego size browns, 30-inch browns. And I mean, he doesn't catch, you know, maybe a couple of years, maybe a few, but there are these absolutely gigantic browns there. But anyway, that's an all season fishery.
Oh, that's all season.
Right. So then you get over closer towards Taos, then you're in around Chama. Chama's a superb river, but it has quite a narrow window of excellence, which would be early summer, mid-June to mid-July, really, is the prime territory for there.
Not April. April's not good there.
No. Well, you never know, you know, with global warming, if you get in a position where you're on a stream and there's snow in the mountains, and it's been cold. And then all of a sudden, you get a 70-degree day, and the water doesn't have a chance to melt and turn it into ice water, but it's just warm and nice. I mean, you can have good fishing like in the middle of winter on certain streams if you're lucky. You know, you have to hit that just right. But once the snow starts melting, the water's 33 degrees, you know, so then you're screwed.
So basically, and then taking it to the Rio Grande, so that will fish before the flood in April.
Probably. Yeah. It's a tricky time of year because, I mean, there is now it's still almost, it's winter, I guess, right? And there's a foot of snow forecast for today there. So,
oh, wow.
But it certainly can snow way into April and be quite nasty of weather. That's the problem with that caddis hatch in April, is the weather is extremely temperamental. So at that time, and it's mountain weather. I mean, it's rowdy. It's way rowdy. Mm-hmm.
Jackson Hole Fly Company may sound like a new brand, but they've actually been around for quite a while, since 1978, in fact. In 2020, they launched jhflyco.com and started selling fly fishing gear directly to anglers all over the country. You can go ahead and check them out right now. They got a huge selection of fly rods, reels, fly lines, tools, accessories, and much more. Thousands of fly tying patterns and all sorts of good stuff. I've been loving my new Jackson Hole sling. It's been great, along with the rod that we're going to be taking out on the upcoming trip, fishing up in the Kamloops. I'm going to be definitely having this one on the water and testing out with some Kamloops rainbows. I'm excited for that. And just like Amazon, they'll ship everything directly to your door, saving you time and money. But unlike Amazon, you'll be supporting a great shop and this podcast by grabbing a few flies. You can check them out right now, jhflyco.com/swing. And right now, you get free shipping on all orders over $50, and you get 25% off your first order. Just go to jhflyco.com/swing, and you get started right now. Go check it out. 25%. Let's do it.
So, okay. So, and then what would be if somebody, you know, was just saying, I want to go there when the fishing's really good, when you can count on it. When would be the best time you'd recommend to head out there? For, say, let's take it to the Rio Grande.
September, October.
Yeah, so the fall.
Yeah.
Is that in general just because the waters cool down?
Well, it's good because there's very little pressure, and the water temperatures are good. August, the middle of August, is a surprising slot. Almost always there's a cool down about the middle of August, and then it might get really hot again early September, but the fishing in general, the best fishing in the Southern Rockies and probably the entire Rockies is late spring. It's June into mid-July. That's when the hatches happen. That's when the gray drakes, green drakes, stoneflies. Because another river we fish a lot, which is just an hour and 20 minutes north of Taos, is the Conejos in Colorado, which is a main feeder of the Rio. And that's fish probably average 17 inches. And they eat on top. They really look up there. So that's an excellent fishery in late spring, early summer.
Late spring. Okay, so basically it's good, and then through the summer and the fall, and then is there a time towards, you know, when you get towards the winter when things just kind of shut down?
Yes, well, like I say, the global warming thing, you know, you just don't. I mean, I was quoted in the Albuquerque Journal on the front page, and everybody said, "Oh, you're like a climate denier." I said, "No, man, that's like." You know, they got like more lobsters than they ever had. Their range has expanded. And, you know, the trout in certain places are doing better. Now, that would be nice if that lasts, but it's probably going to all end in a big explosion one day. But for right now, you know, there are some good parts to the climate change. So, yeah. I mean, if you're a fisherman, not if you're a farmer, probably, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's good and bad, and who knows where all this is going. But okay, so that gives a little snippet of kind of the area you're in and some general fishing things.
Right.
I'm going to go back to the shop because you gave, you know, you built this shop, right? So you said in 1980 you opened the doors. When you started that thing, did you know this thing was going to be like a successful shop? This thing was doing well?
Well, actually, I started at a very bad time. I was my drinking, on a personal note, was a little extreme, but another thing that happened is we had a mine in the neighborhood that really just about killed Rio Grande, and it did a really rough number on the Red River, which feeds the Rio Grande. And the mine's been gone a long time now, but that's when I opened the shop. And so that was tough. And then the mine closed, and then I was continuing to guide by myself, but I was training my son Nick, who is now the greatest fishing guide on earth, except for our other 17 guide, but he's they're all just so good, and it's just an amazing crew. And then I trained him in the sense that we'd go out on trips with, say, three people, and I'd say, take care of that guy, move him over there, and you brought the lunches, right? And then he reopened the Tile Slaw Shop because I closed it in 1987.
Oh, wow.
The year I got sober, actually. So, and then around 2000, he reopened the shop, and then he moved it. It got bigger and bigger, and now it's in a quite large location. He's got, I don't know, 10 people working in the shop. I mean, you know, two or three people at a time. And we have 17 guides and do a pretty big business. And he and Ivan Valdez also own the fly shop in Santa Fe called The Real Life. I just sending a box of 50 of my instinctive book to Ivan at the shop in Santa Fe for the college course they teach on fly fishing. So we did a lot of schools, and a guide school was a big deal. We used to do a school with it all started with schools we did every year with AK Best. And we would do and it was in that Caddis Hatch was when we did it, God willing. And we would tie flies in the morning, and then the fish activity was in the afternoon. So then we'd fish in the afternoon. It was a wonderful school. It was really a gas to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So, and I want to get on the timing here. This is so 1980, you opened the shop. 1987, it sounds like you had a period there where you struggle with some the alcohol and things like that. So 87, you close the shop. So it's closed for 13 years before Nick opens it up.
Yes. Right. And I was guiding on my own. And now to guide without a physical location, well, let's say, despite all the booze, I got pretty good at the job because people kind of really want to find you if you're not. So I was doing 100 jobs a year. And then a while after I guess in the 90s, somewhere in there, I started working in the Bahamas.
Oh, wow.
And I ran South Andros. I ran two different fishing operations there and spent quite a bit of time, 5 years, I think, going there. And then after that, which is a whole nother story, but after that, I started taking people to Argentina, and I did that for 20 years.
20 years. That started in – and you started doing that in the 90s?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And in fact, I heard Justin Spence on there, and I took Justin to there. He used to work with my son in a fly shop in Albuquerque.
And, that's right.
I took him both there. Yeah.
you're bringing together some of our past guests, because now I remember, yeah, Justin mentioned you guys, and
right.
You've had a lot of people. Yeah, Nick, I think, did, and there's just been a whole bunch of people along the way. So you've had, it sounds like you've had kind of a little bit of a up and down, rocky. It's not like you just built this fly shop and it became the biggest fly shop in the world. You literally had some ups and downs. Does it feel like it's been bumpy for you?
Well, you look around and you look at the person walking over there and you go, is it as bumpy for them as it is for me? any rate, I guess it's the human condition, but as far as the fishing business goes, I mean, I'm out of it now as far as,
yeah.
I got to really despise parts of the business, like the permits with the government,
yeah.
were just
right.
a nightmare for me, because I tried to tell them, I'm a fishing guide because I'm not good at papers and numbers and regulations, my God. And so, yeah. They, the BLM and the Forest Service, they eat us up. They can't very well complain to Ted Turner and, certain people, but fishing guides are at their mercy, and all they got to do is put the foot down and then you're out of business, So,
right.
And this is the time of year I would be working on permits, and I'm not for the first year in 50 years. And it's just such an incredible relief. Not dealing with it. Yeah.
It feels good. So like you said at the start, you got the weed and all that stuff. I mean, you're like a counterculture. You're in that environment, but you had to basically do this passion, right? Fly fishing was your passion, and you had a little bit of I don't know what the word is. You had to deal with the government, but Nick's there now. Like, did you think Nick is a little bit different on his take on all this? Like, he's taken over the shop. How does it look a little different now?
Nick is more like my brother in that sense than I am. And
what advice did you give to Nick when you transitioned to say, well, I guess he just opened the shop, but did you ever say, hey, here's my best advice. You're doing this thing. Like, you told him something.
Yeah. Well, when he was maybe 16, I was starting to get famous and getting a lot of ink. And I said, you could do something with this. And then after a while he did, and he follows my brother's thing. And my brother Jackson Strite is the mountain angler in Breckenridge, Colorado, and he has a massive guiding business and is a real serious player in the fishing world, because he takes people fishing all over, especially to Mexico. But my son, everyone should meet my son, because he's got a 6-minute YouTube of fishing the Rio Grande that is done by a friend of ours, Greg Flores. And it's just fish porn. Like, he lands 113 fish in 6 minutes. And but it's a really good one of the river. But he's, he's good friends with our Senator Martin Heinrich, who's a he turned Martin on to a 6-point elk this fall, and we all hunt a lot.
Oh, you do? So you're all big game hunters.
Yeah, and small game.
Cool. So basically, yeah, Nick is doing it. And then you said Nick was the one that turned the Senator on to the big elk.
Yeah, he did. It could have been a Nick and Garrett Venterclausen, who's another part of the troop, and they hunted together this last fall. Yeah.
Okay, good. And I had two other quick questions, and then we're going to get back to fishing. But we had a guest on recently on the podcast, and he surprised me, because he said right at the start of the episode when we got going, he said, hey, he was telling his story, and he said, yeah, and I found myself on the street. I was living on the street. I was basically a bum.
Uh-huh.
He was an alcoholic and a bum, and he was, and I was like, wow, it took me by surprise. But fly fishing took him back out of that world and gave him a new life, right? And it was pretty powerful for you. I've had alcoholism in my family as well, so I know the struggles. But I mean, how did you get out of that? Right, you're in it. How did in 87? How did you find yourself to get clean? Was that a challenge?
Couldn't ingest anymore. I just, it was like
your body was shutting down, basically telling you.
Yeah, I was almost dead. And I went to treatment and such. But yeah, no, I was quite bad. And yeah, this book I'm writing, my book is entitled, I've got a picture of myself, this memoir book I'm working on now. I've had five different books, and this will be number six. And nice. I've found this old Polaroid picture from maybe the 60s of me holding a 22-inch trout with my stringy hair and a joint sticking out of my mouth. and I'm holding this fish. And the title for the book is going to be Which Way is Upstream? Which is a quote you get on occasion from a client when you're guiding, and then you know you're in for a long day. But the alternative title, a guy named Dan Boyne, who's a writer for Nick for Lions Press, he thinks it should be called "How Fly Fishing Saved My Life," but I find that a little dry. But it would be good in there, you know.
Yeah, I like Which Way is Upstream. I think that's the one, because right. Even if you don't know what that means, it's still it's still interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I've been working on that chapter about guiding. You know, about how when I started guiding, I kept notes on the fishing, the flies, the insects, the timing, and then it just gradually over time just became about the clients. Because then I knew about the fish, and that was deep inside of me, right? But the clients were always a surprise, and I realized there, as far as writing, there's a lot of stories to tell about taking people fishing. It's a pretty intimate thing. You learn a lot about somebody in 8, 10, 12 hours, whatever a day is.
That's right. Yeah, you've had a whole, like, pretty much everybody, right? You've probably guided just about every type of person out there. Does it feel like that was the thing you really loved as you know in the guiding, is just the people?
Yeah, we have guiding schools, and I say that, you know, and one of my guides, Emily, who has a great YouTube, I forget what it's called, Emily Rowley is her name.
Oh, okay. I'll put a link in the show notes to her channel. And that video you said too, the 6-minute video of Nick, I'll put a link in our show notes as well.
Oh, cool.
So we can take a look at that.
That'd be great. Thank you. Where was I with that?
Well, the school. Yeah. Now, do you have a guiding school itself?
Yeah. Well, Nick's doing it now, and my other guides, the real experienced guides, but I'm not doing it myself anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. But you guys teach, you actually teach guides how to be guides.
Yes. Yes. And it's a very interesting thing. And we'll get, say, 10 people, and we'll spot one person and go, oh man, this is the personality for this. And that's really, and it's even somebody who might not have the experience of the other people. They've just got the personality for it, you know, and they know how to, you know, they've got manners and show up on time and do things like that. I mean, it's not all about just the skills. And a lot of it is about the outdoors. You know, the best of our 17 guides, the better ones are usually from New Mexico. They're usually have a vested interest in protecting the environment, right, for one thing, and they, you know how things go, and been fishing the water since they're little kids, you know. So
that's it.
So that's good. But the guide school, you know, you tell people, man, this is a really bad idea to make a living, and they said, yeah, but you're making $200-$300 a day. And I said, well, okay, now look at that a little closer, because that's for a season that's about 3 or 4 months long.
That's, right.
You know, you're not getting that 365 days a year.
No.
So, you know, it's not much. And I was very fortunate to, you know, I mean, I retired with a pretty good take at the end. And, you know, and I had my book income too, but the guiding is it's a rough way to go. And the people, I mean, I've got all these grown men, not college age people, but grown men who've been doing this for 20 years. And, you know, we're just a great outfit to work for because the guides, because we have a lot of choices of water and the guides get their say. They got the clients and they're, and then nobody is afraid to ask the next guide, what should I do with these people? You know, because you try and match the client to the water. And like, for instance, in the canyon of the Rio Grande, we're only going to have 1 out of 10 clients that can hike in out of the canyon and then have the skill to fish the very complicated currents there. It's tricky.
Oh, that's the Rio Grande. Like if I was to come there, like we were saying, you know, before that I could hike in there. I love that sort of hiking, you know, that'd be my style. But but you get in there now, the fishing's tricky too. The whole thing is tricky.
Well, there's some stretches up, but if you fish like riffle stretches where you don't have a lot of current to read, you know, you, just anybody can probably do pretty good. But, you know, where the big fish are is in deeper water that's broken with a lot of rocks with medium speed currents. And so you really need to have the right positioning. We take a lot of people from Colorado who are fish big rivers that get pounded to death.
Yeah, that's right.
And they fish our job with those people in the Rio Grande is shortening up their cast and getting closer to the fish and not mending. And, you know, one of the big jobs a guide has in our case, you know, in other streams is different, but in northern New Mexico, the fish are generally pretty dumb. And so they'll usually take whatever fly comes by. And it's more about, like I heard Larry Dahlberg say on your show, which I really appreciated. It's not it's not what people think about flies. It's what the fly does and what it's for, you know. So I have one fly that's become pretty famous. It's called the Poundmeister, and it's a great big crane fly nymph on a big hook. And if the fish take it, you're much more likely to land a big fish on a big hook. And so, you know, you get down to the intricacies of guiding, and a lot of it is just common sense stuff. And that's like my instinctive book.
Who would I be going with there, Taylor? If I was to go into your talk to Nick and say, "Hey, I really want to go into the canyon for a day," are there all of the guides could take me down there? Would it
pretty
be just
much.
Like, yeah, okay,
pretty much. There's a couple guys that may have only been guiding for 2, 3, 4 years that maybe not, you know, we've got a lot of beginner fishing too. Another thing we have there that I may be not the right time to say this, but I think it is, it may come up and open up this year, is there's a massive Rio Grande cutthroat.
Oh, the Slam.
Yeah, it's in an area called the Vividal, which is an extremely gorgeous high elevation, 10,000 foot country. And it's a the world's biggest native trout restoration project. And it may open up this year because they've had to remove all of the hybrids that have been in there. But that's also another big factor in our fishing is that it's the Rio Castilla is the actual stream.
Rio Castilla. Okay. So,
yeah.
So there's a bunch of, and we haven't touched on everything today. Obviously there's a bunch of different rivers. I mean, what would you say again? So New Mexico, what have we not taught? What would be important things to be thinking about if you're going to plan a trip there? What would you tell somebody? Or just grab your book probably is a good way to do it. Grab one of your books, right? But
yeah, well, it's the new book. It's like, you know, Fly Fish Style Santa Fe. And that's only a year old. So it's quite up to date. You know, I was trying to, somebody said, well, I can just go get a used guidebook. And I said, well, I wrote that used guidebook and I know that most of it's dated.
I can tell you, looking at this is that the great thing about this is that this book, those maps, I mean, I love maps, but
that's Pete Chatwell's map. He's your neighbor, Pete Chatwell.
Oh, those are awesome. Yeah, because they're super, they're clear, they're colorful, they're not too detailed, but they're really easy. Right. So if you're going, I mean, when we go there, and we're heading there sometime, but I'm going to have this book right next to me as I'm going because this is great. But so let's say somebody doesn't have the book in front of them right now. What else do you tell them if they're coming there? They're planning a trip right now. What else do you tell them about planning a trip?
Well, obviously, getting guided is a big deal.
Yeah. So you think you need to spend at least a day with a guide?
Well, if you spend a day with a guide, and I'll give you some little tips, you don't say, I'm planning to build a house right here by the property as close as I can to here and fish here every day after you take me fishing. You say, okay, I'm going to fish here. I'll probably never come back, so you can show me your best spot. So, something about booking a guide trip, and this is true anywhere, is the farther you do it in advance, the better. You're going to have the best choice for guide. But
how far in advance? How far in advance would you say? Like if I was planning a trip, I would just want to, a year out? Month.
No, a month, 2 months maybe. But then try and be flexible at the end. In other words, you might all the time we'll have, say, people that want to fish the Rio Grande, but then when we meet them, they might weigh 800 pounds and that's not going to work out, you know. So we have to steer them somewhere else, or the condition of the water might be bad. So you can't really hold rigid notions. You have to roll with the punches on that thing, and that's why you have a guide, because people get this idea what they want, and maybe that's just not in the cards, you know.
Gotcha. So if we take it back to me, you know, again, I'm always thinking about this example, but if I was coming there and I wanted to say check out the canyon, would be really amazing, but also I think it'd be fun to do like a float trip. Are there a number of places you can do float trips?
Well, we have, we're the only ones. There's a floating the Rio is a big deal. It's big business when the water's high, but when the water's low, there's and when it's high like that, it's not fishable. But we have a float that we're doing in what's called the middle box, and the middle box is it's real skinny floating. And so sometimes it gets so low they have to push the boats through a couple spots. And that's a camp float. That can be just a fabulous choice to do that. A lot of the places that you fish can be reached on foot from the canyon by four-wheel drive. But the lower part of the river is also floatable, and we've been doing a great number of trips. Evan Clausen just called me.
Yeah.
And he's been floating the
this
lower
the
part of the Rio Grande. Yeah, in the Rio, right. And there's a lot of wild fish, but there's a lot of stockers that carry over. And so there's a lot of, pretty much wild fish if they're in there for a couple of years extra. Yeah.
Bear Vault keeps wild adventure going and assures your next backcountry trip stays memorable, epic, and safe. Bear Vault builds a rugged polycarbonate locking canister that keeps bears and other wild animals out of your food. This in turn keeps your food safe, keeps bears safe, and keeps you safe. I've got a classic story I've been telling for a while about the bear that stole my backpack. It was kind of a crazy story at the time, but now is kind of funny. I left some food in the pack, didn't seal it up, and the bear just kind of walked up and grabbed it. It took off. Never saw that backpack again. So that was one of my stories. I've had some encounters along the way, but it's definitely awesome having the Bear Vault, because now you don't have to worry about this. If you're out there, you can just lock it up and you're good to go. And now you too can experience all of the great stuff of the remote backpacking trips or your trips out there with the bears and not have to worry about fiddling with your stuff. Sleep soundly knowing your vault has you covered. The Bear Vault also has some great bonus features like the see-through walls so you can check out what you have going. Plus, one of my favorites, it doubles as a camp stool. This is awesome. Who doesn't love another camp stool? be the guy who has the epic trip, not the guy who has to hike out early because he got pounced by a bear. Bear Vault, they got you covered. Check it out right now. wetflyswing.com/bearvault. That's BEARVAULT. You support this podcast by clicking over to check out Bear Vault right now.
Are you, when you're out there, you yourself fishing, are you kind of mostly doing like dry fly fishing when you can, or are you mixing up like doing streamers and like everything?
Well, it's funny. You know, I hear so much talk about flies and, you know, and I basically put on a Royal Stimulator and I guess I can say it on the air. You can cut it. The shit fly is my invention.
Oh, you got a fly called the shit fly?
Yeah. And in fact, John Shuey did an article about it. And
Oh, nice.
And I think he went there. I think he published it, as I recall. And some of my other patterns too. But it's just a hare's ear without bothering with all of the stuff, just the fur and the bead.
Yeah.
So I fish those two flies, and then I'll be fishing with somebody who changes flies a lot, and they may catch more fish at some point, but almost always that particular rig is going to catch as many fish. I mean, I got real lazy in the latter years of my thing.
That's awesome. No, I love this. I love this though, because this is perfect. Yeah. So basically the Royal Stimulator and the shit fly, somebody could literally put those two, that setup on, and probably go to the Rio Grande or the San Juan and probably catch a number of fish.
San Juan's the exception. The San Juan is the tiny, tiny 28s, insanely small flies. And, and I heard the best thing on that. Before he died, I did a show in Texas and with Lefty, and I was having dinner with him and some other folks that were in the show, and Lefty said something I couldn't believe. You know, he was such a cool cat. I was sick at the time, and he met me and he said, "Man, you don't look good." But the thing from him, that's like, he really cares, you know, like he was a real human guy. So, but he had this theory, and it's just the greatest thing on the tiny flies in San Juan. He says, you know, those fish don't have fingers to feel that stuff, and they put those flies in their mouth to see what it is. And it's too small. So they just put it in their mouth.
Exactly.
I thought, nobody's thought of that before.
Yeah. So. Lefty's right. Yeah, no, that is good. And I love the Lefty stories for sure. So he was a good guy. You know, and we're going to probably start wrapping this up here in a little bit, but I had a couple, I want to dig in a little more on the fishing. And then if we have a couple more chances for maybe another Lefty story or something, we'll dig into that. But so when you talk about the two flies there and you're just kind of fishing, fishing those, you're just like a dry dropper sort of setup. Is that kind of what you're running there or what you like to, your simplest setup? Right. Is that what you're doing?
That would be the simplest one. The Royal Stimulator. Now, they used to come, I believe, from Umpqua, and there's somebody that ties those, who knows of their however many fly tires they have, with a material that is a floating material, and somebody ties it, I'm thinking from years back. So you got to get the right stimulator, because some of them get waterlogged and some of them don't. Anyway, and it's one of the only flies. Why that's such a great choice is this. Is because it's one of the very few flies that refloats itself. So it gets into really rough water, it goes under the surface, and it pops back up. Not many flies do that. And when you're guiding, one of our biggest factors in guiding is people setting the hook on the nymph strike so that they set it hard enough and fast enough. And it's a monster. It's ask any guide that makes his living on the water, and he'll tell you that's the secret.
You need to set it hard and fast.
Yeah. Well, hard, you know, it depends on what tippet you're using. But, you know, like in the Rio Grande, you're using 3X or 4 maybe, but fluorocarbon, of course. But so having that fly that can float really well. And, you know, the one you put on in the morning is going to be too waterlogged after a few fish in a couple hours. Yeah. So you need to change them out. But that would be the rig. And then, but one other thing, when you come to deeper water, especially if you think there's big fish there, you go deeper. And you go deeper by adding a third fly. And you put about 18 inches chest tie to the nymph and add, say, 18 inches. So you got three flies. Now, you got to know that oval cast so you don't get tangled. Yeah. And right. that's a big point I make in my instinctive book is, you know, you've a regular cast, you're just going to be tangled all the time. So, you know, have to know how to make that kind of...
What is the oval cast?
Well, you're kind of swinging around in an oval like a helicopter or something. You know, you're going around. If you make a tight loop, then the flies are going to slam into each other and get all tangled. Yeah. So even when you set the hook, when you've got that rig and you set the hook, you set it and you're going to miss more than you're going to hook, but you make sure it swings around as you do it and so it doesn't get tangled. And I mean, I remember fishing for years and years and never knowing to do that and spend half my time on the bank untangling. But untangling. If you go around in an oval, it's a different cast.
When you say go around an oval, do you mean like I'm coming like a normal back cast behind me and then going an oval, or I'm doing like a sidearm cast with an oval?
Yeah, it kind of starts with a sidearm. Yeah, starts with a sidearm, and you're coming around.
Oh, and you come around on top, right?
In a big old oval, so that yep. The whole rig goes around. It slings around, and there's no tight loop to get tangled. You follow?
Yeah. You don't want the tight loop.
I used to do those the fly fishing show, and be a celebrity there at the fly fishing show, and I would always follow like Chico Fernandez or Lefty, and they would be casting, and Rajiv, and they would be casting forever. And I'm coming up and I'm showing these 20 and 30 foot casts, you know, like a tip cast or that cast especially. And, it was, people, paid attention once they realized that this is actually what you need to do when you're fishing, and you never need to cast 90 feet, you know. So that was an interesting demo I had set up.
Yeah. You mentioned in your instinctive book about eddy fishing. Is this what is that about when you say eddy fishing? Is that
that's a great question because eddy fishing, one of the best places to fish a river is the eddies, because almost everybody will cast. So your eddy, if you cast to the eddy with line on the water, you're not going to get adrift. So you have to sneak into the eddy, and you can do that by coming across, by wading. There's going to be a fast current, and you can wade close to that fast current usually without spooking the fish, and then reaching over with your arm as far as you can. I know there's a drawing of that. It was actually done by Pete Chadwell too. Reaching over, and you just drop those flies straight down, right. Or you do it from the bank, but you stay back as far as you can.
And
you
just walk line on the water.
Walk on tiptoes. Exactly. So it goes straight down. And one of the really cool ways to do it, and this is like coming, you know, there's a lot about in my book and in the guiding, there's a lot about dexterity with a fly rod. It's really difficult to drop a fly in, just drop it straight down from your rod and do it at the right pace, so that it's going at the sink rate. And so it's going down and the fish takes it and just hooks itself. because it's just about tight. I mean, it's a Euro nymph kind of thing, right?
Yeah,
and so,
exactly.
So in fact, the Euro rod would be really good for that eddy circumstance. So if you know where there's a bunch of eddies in a river that you're fishing and you don't do that well in them, then you fish it different. You try and get really close and drop it straight down. And that's where a really large fish would like. And yeah. And of course, they'd like to rise in those spots too, especially if there's foam on it.
That's right. So if there's a hatch off, it's good. Yeah.
Right.
Foam is good. Foam right. is home.
Yeah. Foam is really good. Right. And sometimes what I've done with the foam, we'd have a lot of that in Argentina when we'd fish there. And is you fish it dry in the foam, but you skate it real slow just so you can see the fly across through the foam. But then the trout see it too, because it's drawing attention, because there's no what's the word? Well, there's so much foam and insects in a particular spot like that, that how they're going to know about yours. And if you yeah. cast your fly, a dry fly into there, it's going to sit on top of the foam. So you want to put something that'll just, you can just skate right through the, at the very
awesome.
Surface. You follow me? And just skate it real slow. Yeah. Like in Argentina. I think the trout are smarter now than when I used to spend a lot of time there. But we moved the fly a lot. We moved to we'd fish lakes with bass poppers and for trout, and you just want to draw their attention, you know. And so fishing for dumb trout's a gas.
Yeah,
beats right. the hell out of it. Anymore when I go trout fishing and I get to a place and I have a fish look at the fly and then turn away, I go, oh, it's been caught. Let's go elsewhere. And it's not like, yeah. you know, I just don't, people get, some people get off on that, but I like, you know, I like the dumb version. So.
Yeah. Do you still get as fired up about your fishing, getting out on the water as you used to?
No.
Yeah. When did that change? Because I look at my dad, who I think he's a lot older than you, but he, I saw the transition. You know, we transitioned from him being the full on fishing all the time, and then I became that person. And I also saw him where he literally started to get out of fishing, and it was partly health related. But I mean, when did that? Do you look back and see that transition just of a life of doing it for 50 years, and you're like, okay, I did enough of that?
Yeah. Well, I would say that I've gotten more practical. I'm like fish to eat. I'm looking for fish to eat. And and that's catfish and walleye and white bass. And they're putting wipers in this lake. I live next to Caballo Lake in New Mexico. So I'm looking for fish to eat. I just, you know, catching a fish and throwing it back, pretty dumb thing to do. So, But catching one and eating it is makes a lot of sense. But I still, if I got up on the Conejos when the green drakes are hatching, I just
you'd still be fired up.
That's a different thing. Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's it.
And I do really like fishing really small streams and way back in the mountains and seeing the country and making a cast here and there. Yeah, that's usually for brookies or cutthroats in that case. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, we all evolve. That's a great thing, right? We all, in our fly fishing journeys, right? Everybody listening here is going to be into one thing, and then it's going to slowly evolve into something. And that's what's great about it, because it's so diverse, right? You don't have to be a cutthroat fisherman your whole life, right? You could fish for bass, and it's amazing.
Right.
So
I can't tell you that the number of people that I guided, normally women, who wanted to fish without a hook. And so you cut the hook off. It's an amazing thing. You cut the hook off, and then the trout eats the fly and swims around with it like a dog with a bone.
Right. And then they let it go.
Yeah.
Do you still get the fight when that happens? Do you still feel, do you get a good fight on the fish for a little bit?
I never seen a fight. I mean, they let go as soon as you pull on it.
They feel it.
Yeah.
Somebody brought that up. I remember, you know, the steelhead runs and things have been down recently. And I know somebody brought that up a while back on an episode where they said, you know what, instead of closing the river down, how about you just let us fish without a hook? you know, and you can still steelhead fish and you're not hurting anything. So that's another thought.
You know, another way to do that is to tie flies on a fine wire hook and spring the hook so that you can actually have the fish on for a really short period of time. And then you just give it a little slam and the hook straightens out and they're gone. I've tried to convince my guides to do that. You don't want to smarten up all these fish.
Exactly. That's good. So tell me this. I just quickly on the hunting, I'm curious because I do a little bit of deer and elk hunting as well. Is hunting for you now that thing that's, you know, even more, are you more passionate about hunting than you are fishing?
Yeah, you know, because I never really made a living at it, you know, so I didn't get kind of ruined by that old phrase, you know, doing what you love. I got a javelina tag. I'm supposed to be out doing that tomorrow. And, you know, it still gets me. And here in southern New Mexico, there's something to hunt about 9 months of the year. So, we love it. I mean, the biggest day in New Mexico is a big game draw day. And everybody, it's like a common phrase. What did you draw?
Yep. So it's all a draw. It's all a lottery system.
Well, yeah. You know, we got so many fancy critters, desert bighorn, mountain bighorn, and oryx, ibex, elk, deer, antelope.
Everything. You guys are loaded.
A lot of stuff. Yeah. And so you get a lot of you don't get that many tags. I had an elk tag and I didn't get one last year, but my son got one with a bow. I'm eating that. And then Evan got one. And so,
So you like the idea of having a nice elk in the freezer.
Yeah. Well, I live right next to the Gila. And, you know, there's gotta be some kind of meat, coming out of there for me.
Yeah. That's perfect.
I got a big old freezer and quail hunt a lot. I got a bird dog.
Oh, quail. Nice. You do some upland. Awesome.
Yeah. But this is the downside of global warming because it isn't rained here in months and rain is the monster factor for quail.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Taylor, I mean, obviously, you know, this is most of these I go and I have a conversation like this and I want to keep going for another hour, but I'll respect your time and let you get out of here. Tell me one random one here. We mentioned Woodstock at the start and CCR. Was that your group? If you had to say one band you really loved, musician or whatever, either now or back in the day, who was that? Or who did you see at Woodstock that really blew you away?
Sly.
Sly?
Sly. Yeah.
No kidding. That's an actual group.
Sly and the Family Stone.
Oh, Sly and I've never even heard of that. That's there you go.
Oh yeah, no, Google them. Yeah, yeah.
I will. I'll put a video of them in the show notes so people can have a listen.
Yeah, Sly.
What is it? Is it like CCR? Is it kind of like CCR?
No. It's like Funkadelic or something like that.
Oh, Funkadelic. Yeah. That's perfect. Yeah, I love the funk. Perfect. All right. Well, this has been fun. So just give me a heads up. It sounds like you're completely retired. You got hunting and stuff. For you, what do you look at as you look at the next year ahead? Is it just kind of a lot of sitting back in the sunshine and enjoying retirement?
No, I don't. I wish. I have this kind of old house and I need to work on it. But I'm writing this memoir, the Which Way's Upstream book, and it's it's been a quite the incredible experience. I would say that everybody should write their biography because you get to relive a lot of stuff and maybe do it over right in your dream that night or something.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. A lot of the stuff you talked about, and I didn't dig into a lot of personal stuff here because, you know, I wanted to kind of respect, you know, all that stuff. But, I mean, the memoir sounds like something where you're letting go. You're letting loose on your whole everything.
Well, you kind of got to, and I think the bottom line with that, it can be embarrassing, but you know, if it does anybody any good, then you gotta put it out, you know?
That's exciting. I'm really, now give me I'm not sure if you have a date, but what could we, because this episode will be living out there for a number of years. When do you think this will be out?
Well, I'd say that I can present it to, it was interesting hearing Nick Lyons because, Well, I'd like to, I better not get into the publishing business, but
right.
In a year I can probably be looking for a publisher.
Yeah. 1 year. Oh, so 1 year and then look for a publisher and then another year to publish it. So like 2 years from now?
Well, I hire an editor. I have an editor, Anne from Helena, and I'm giving her a plug. So
yeah.
She's a great.
Well, when do you think, if I was to go give her a plug first and then tell me when, if I could go just and buy your book, when do you guesstimate, when do you think that would be?
A year and a half.
Okay, year and a half. That's good. I just want to nail you down a little bit here because we left a lot on the table as far as a lot of stuff I'm interested in your background. You know what I mean? So I'm really excited to get
I got some stories, believe me.
All right. Well, we'll leave that maybe for next one, or maybe we talk to, I'm not sure how much of the story Nick knows, but we might get him on down the line as well. So
I've got the, I just wrote a couple of days ago, the Marlon Brando drawing. I was in a restaurant in Taos, you know, everybody goes to Taos, and Marlon Brando's sitting at the table next to me, and we're the only people in the restaurant. And everybody's coming up and bothering him and everything, and I don't say nothing to him. And then he ate four desserts. That was in his heavyweight days. And and then he left, and the waitress comes over and holds up his placemat, which is an absolute perfect pencil drawing of me sitting there eating dinner. And I reach up to grab it, and she says, "I'm keeping it." And that's the last I saw.
Wait a minute. Now, you're saying Marlon Brando drew a picture of you?
Yeah. Yeah. And
that is crazy.
You know, I think it was before there was a copier machine. It was like 50 years ago, you know?
So
I never saw it again. I never heard about anything. And, you know.
And that waitress is probably, that drawing is somewhere out there probably still.
That was New Mexico in the olden days. You know, that's how things rolled. So,
you painted a picture of New Mexico and Mexico, that whole thing down there, of this really interesting place that I think that like people are probably going to want to go to if they haven't been there. It sounds like a really unique part of the country.
It is that. Yes, yes. And the landscape is so, you know, just up the road from me is Bosque del Apache, which is people come from all over the world to birds. It's New Mexico's like got 450 species of birds.
Wow, so, this is cool, and I love birds too. So, all right, Taylor, I'm going to let you get out here. I appreciate you taking the time today and shedding some light on your background and history. This has been a lot of fun, and appreciate everything you've given to fly fishing and over the years. It's been awesome.
Well, you're doing quite a bang-up job yourself, Dave, so thank you.
So there you go. If you want to find all the show notes, all links, and every other thing we cover today, wetflyswing.com/313. Just a reminder, if you want to follow this episode up, and we talked about Nick, Taylor's son, on this episode, you can go over right now to the Destination Angler podcast and check out what Steve has going. He interviewed, the title is Going Deep into the Rio Grande, the Rio Grande Gorge with Nick Streit. So you can go, I'll have a link down in the show notes to check that out. Definitely have a listen to that one. Steve does a great job over there. Before we get out here, just want to remind you, we've got giveaways going, some big giveaways right now. wetflyswing.com/giveaway. Check it out, and you can enter easily to win whatever big one we got. I'm not even sure right now. We got a lot of stuff going. Hope you're having a good day. Hope you're enjoying it. I really am glad that you had a chance to listen in here. That episode with Taylor was, to me, I always love the ones that, they're a little bit different. And, it's, you know, New Mexico is a place that is definitely has a different vibe. And I think that's probably one reason why we all need to eventually get out there and check it out. Not to mention the good fishing. So, okay. I'm going to get out of here. I am going to take it on to the next one. I've got like 5 podcast episodes that I need to kind of get rolling in the editing room, get them ready for Dom. So, I want to thank Dom. Cheers to you for doing this. You've been doing an awesome job. And cheers to you if you're listening right now and to listening till the very end. Have a good night wherever you are. See you on the water or see you online.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.